Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Start this week, in the middle of the week, 2 days gone, I'll explain, not that you didn't know already, but just to make, you know the old rule, tell them what you're going to do, do it, and then tell them what you did. Monday, we were gone, I was gone, you were right there, but Monday, I went down to Charleston for a meeting along with a lot of friends and colleagues, with some fairly higher-ups from the EPA. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that. Oh, dear. And then yesterday, of course, I hope you were tuned in. I hope you were tuned in to last night's PRISM West Virginia chat with Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly. You know, there's because this is an academic program that is geared toward, I mean, this is a grant, a federal grant, geared toward helping American history teachers better teach American history, and especially American history teachers in a certain segment of southern West Virginia. There's a certain amount of sort of academic housekeeping involved, but if you stick around and you catch, if you just stay with it, you will find historical a discussion of American history unlike anything you're likely to hear anywhere else, and of that I am certain. And last night was no different. Of course, it's always viewable at our Ustream channel, and I sent the audio file to Ben Birch last night for inclusion on the Horn's White Rose page. Okay? So that's where we were, and then that brings us to today. Now, today there was something on the agenda, too, but it didn't interfere with showtime. And the something that was on the agenda today was a site visit to a mountaintop removal operation. Didn't happen. For reasons that I will explain. Now, when you're going to go up, the site visits happen not because the coal companies are all warm and fuzzy and want you to see what they're doing. They would really rather you didn't. But it is written into the statute that people who are affected in the community can go up and visit. Well, that we were prepared to do. In advance of this, conversations were had with the West Virginia Department of Environmental Permitting, I mean protection. Protection. about what was needed to go up there. It's a mine site. It's a work site. It's a devastation zone. And we were told quite clearly that what we needed to do was to have hard hats and steel-toed boots. Okay. Well, you know what? We went and got steel-toed boots. $100. Goodbye, $100. I don't need any steel-toed boots. But if you're going to do this, you got to have it. So trying to be compliant, that's what we did. Away we went. Last night, as we went over to do the PRISM chat, we in search of steel-toed boots, we stopped at Kmart. Yeah, and got steel-toed boots, one pair for Agnes, one pair for me, to the tune of $100. Now, remember, the Department of Environmental Permitting, or Protection, or Permitting, whatever, prostitution, Department of Environmental Prostitution, had said hard hats, steel-toed boots. They had the hard hats. We bring the steel-toed boots. And so we stopped at Kmart. It's so cute. Agnes, you know, they don't have women's steel-toed boots at Kmart. So Agnes got into a pair of men's six and a halves. It's just cute. And still had room to spare. I could have gotten her a five and a half. Children's shoes. Now I got a pair for myself. Got her a pair. Paid for them. Got up early this morning. Went all the way over to the mine office, where we were met by the Department of Environmental Protection reps and reps from the coal company. You got metatarsal support protection devices on them shoes you're a-wearing? No, you didn't say anything about metatarsal protection on the shoes, boots we were wearing there, Gomer. Well, you can't go up on the mountain without no metatarsal supports over your shoe booties. Right, okay. No, we got us a list here. Well, why didn't we see the list when this was all being discussed and put together? Well, no. Meanwhile, the little functionary from the Department of Environmental Prostitution or Protection is standing there with this little smirk on his face. Hey, Bub, did you know about this? I ain't never heard about nothing this, no how, no way. I didn't. Yeah, you gotta have your metatarsal protection on your shoe booties as well as a stainless steel toe. And you got to have yourself a hard hat, and you got to have yourself a reflective vest. Anybody here got a reflective vest? No, you don't. You ain't going up. And you got to have metacarpal gloves, and you got to have eyewear protection. You know, this here is an active mine site. All the while, that every time we tried to get the visit, well, there's really nothing going on up there. Nothing to see. Uh-huh. You got to have your pants properly bloused into your boots. Y'all ain't got properly bloused pants into your boots, even if they did have metacarpal tarpal boot protection shoes. See, you wear those. I mean, they serve a real function. If you work in an underground mine, or perhaps in a quarry. The metatarsal protection is something is hard, and it's a part of the boot that goes up over the top of your arch of your foot, so that if something really heavy lands on it, it won't crush your foot and render you permanently crippled. But suggesting that one needs to wear those up on a up on this site is like saying that you need metatarsal protection to go squirrel hunting. Not really. Not to suggest that the woods are still there, or the squirrels, because they're not. So it was long about that time that it was Agnes and me and another couple from another wife-husband team from here in the area. And there were three representatives from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. We start looking over at them. Now, these are inspectors, and they get to go up on your site anytime they want to, right? Uh-huh, absolutely. We're fully compliant with the West Virginia DEP. Hey, buddy, you got any metatarsal protection in them boots? Mm-mm, nope. How about you? Nah, I'll never wear none of that. You? Mm-mm. But we gotta.
Well, safety's job. See, we call it 1A and 1B, safety and production. It's not really one and two that are not, are compliance. Compliance is number. Production is way down there. We call it 1A and 1B, not 1 and 2. Safety and compliance with the law. It's 1A and 1B, not even 1 and 2. They're both number 1. I'm not kidding you. I wish the hell I was. Nervous. I mean them, those mine fellers were nervous as a whore in church. It is Wednesday, after all, so we can use those kind of metaphors. I'll get emails saying, well, that was certainly sexist of you, Bob. It was not intended as sexism. Okay, how about nervous as a wax cat in hell? Well, let's see what you got against the cats, Bob. Get over yourself. No, they were. They were downright jumpy. And so we said, well, are the DEP guys going to have all of this stuff on when we come back? Well, no. Just us. Just the people. Well, yeah, we just want to make sure you're safe. Now, and here was, this was the kicker. And I tell you what, I went in and I talked to the boss, and he says, if y'all stay in the car and don't get out and try to walk around or see anything we don't want you to see, you can go up as you are. But if you want to get out of the truck and look around, you think, well, no, we can't let you do that. No. So that was our morning. After having gone out last night and spent $100 we didn't have on steel-toed boots. I don't know. I'll wear them weed-eating or something. Jesus, you feel like Herman Munster with them on. You know, Lily? Boom, boom. I mean, you could do the Peter Boyle bucking wing from Young Frankenstein in these things. If you're blue and you don't know where to go to. Right. So we're titling this, Bob and Agnes Get Screwed Out of $100 by the Coal Company. And why the hell not? They've already screwed us out of our air. They've screwed Agnes and my two daughters out of a vital bodily organ. They're screwing us out of our water. So why not come after the wallet? After all, they want it. Everybody, come on. All! Thank you, Marty. What have you got against the cats, Bob? I'm so grateful for the help we receive on this program. I just can't express it. No, so that was the beginning of the day. And but truth be told, I have been anxious for this day to come around for quite some time. Well, since last Friday, because I knew I wouldn't be on the air Monday. I knew I wouldn't be on the air last night, and so I knew that everything that piled up over the weekend was going to have to wait until today. And just at the same time, you just sort of pray that it's not that it won't all have gone stale, you know, you pray that the Repiglicans won't suddenly get sane. And they're not. Oh, they're not. Okay, this is going to be sports related, so don't everybody turn away because it's not about sports. It's about Repiglicans and the stupid. Those of you who do follow sports have probably figured out by now that my beloved Mountaineers, for reasons that certainly evade me, have got it into their heads that they would like to join the Big 12 and start playing football every year against Texas Tech, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Kansas, etc., etc., etc. Because, you know, that would be so much cooler than playing in the SEC, not that we've gotten an invitation from them. I mean, let's see. What are your choices? Every season, if you were in the SEC, maybe you'd make a trip down to Lexington, Kentucky. Maybe over to Columbia, South Carolina. Maybe you'd go down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or Baton Rouge. or Oxpatch, Mississippi, or Starkville. Now, that's not saying Starkville's just a happening place, but really. On the other hand, you could join the Big 12 and go to Lawrence, Kansas, or Lubbock. You know, that's what it's on my bucket list. I swear to God it is. I can't, you know, one of these days I just got to go to Lubbock. Not. But still, it was all kind of ready to roll. But not anymore. See, what it would mean for WVU to leave the Big 12 is it would mean really bad things for football for the remainders. And it would also mean a diminution, a further diminution of the Big East Basketball Conference. And so apparently, Rick Pitino, who coaches basketball at Louisville, sorry, Corey, it's just the truth, has gotten involved with Kentucky Senator and Senate Minority Leader Chinless Mitch McConnell, the turtle with the right wing, and they've decided that they're gonna throw a monkey wrench in the works and try to stop WVU leaving the Big East, and so it's all on hold now. And just by trying to look at the bigger picture here, just a simple question for Chinless Mitch McConnell. The hell are you thinking? How many people are unemployed in this country? Just asking. People are being attacked by cops on a real meme tear in places like Oakland, California right now. A Marine vet was shot down with a rubber bullet, knocked out flat in the street. I guess we're just lucky they weren't using the real thing. And Chinless Mitch McConnell has nothing better to do than to muddle around in whether or not West Virginia University's women's softball team can make repeated annual trips to Lubbock. What the hell happened to that smaller government he wants? Because that's some big government meddling. I mean, that's real live big government meddling. Corey in the Free State of Louisville says, I hadn't heard it was Rick Pitino. I've heard rumors it was Jurich talking with Addison. Addison being Chinless Mitch. Mitch isn't his real name. All these right-wing senators and Congress critters and stuff, they go by assumed names. Kind of like Joe Wilson, South Carolina, whose name isn't really Joe. We don't even know his name's Wilson. Hell, nobody's seen his birth certificate. Corey notes, Pitino is for staying in the Big East. It may have been Rick. I don't know. I'm not discounting it, but I hadn't heard that. I just heard that a little bit before showtime. Smaller government. Unless they're fooling with your uterus or your athletics conference. That's a hell of a caveat for the Repiglicking party, isn't it? We're small government Repiglickins unless we're messing with your sports or a woman's insides. But that's all. All in the gay people. We want to be intimately involved with their lives too, in more ways than one. Did you hear about the right wing family values the mayor from New Jersey? Yeah, he's a real piece of work. A rent boy posted a that's their term, not mine. Posted a photograph of the mayor in his underoos, asleep on a bed. Shot at an angle from above. He's wearing nothing but his underoos. Says the mayor promised him a car. Didn't come through. Mayor's family values were pig licking, wife and kids. Oh, well. Remember, it's not about the sexuality. It's about the hypocrisy. It's a hell of a closet, that right-wing closet. And, you know, Rick Santorum, remember, is willing to die on a hill. Just like Jesus did. To keep the gays from getting married. Economic advice coming in from Kim. Steel-toed boots. Couple of suggestions for you and Agnes's boots. Sell them on eBay for a proper loss. Let Agnes use them next year for planters on your front porch. Or wear them to a pig licking rally and accidentally stub your toe on others' ankles. Pardon me. Coming through. Lady with a baby. Hot pizza. One side. Layover. Ow! Thanks, Kim. That's beautiful. We'll save them for, you know, mucking out the wet basement from time to time or something like that. Or whenever I want to do my Peter Boyle impression from Young Frankenstein. I'm on the Ritz! Suggestions are welcome, of course. So that's just kind of a starting place, and do remember this note coming in from Kate. Subject line, anniversary night. Don't make me come over there and sing. Listeners, come on, y'all. Pony up and pay for those boots for Bob and Agnes. $10 each will do it. It ain't that hard. Let's keep the mic hot for another month. And it is. This is the evening that we are officially going to observe our 6th anniversary here at the Horn. You know, you just do the math real quick. That's 2005. And just to think about how much has happened in those 6 years, whoa. I mean, it blows my mind. But we're still here, and we're still standing, and we're doing it because of you. Because of you. We'd have been gone a long time ago without you, and that's the truth. Further suggestions. David in Tennessee, my head writer. Gently wash the soles and take them back to Kmart. These hurt our feet. A store credit will be fine. And then, but also remember, there are 3 teenagers in this house. They may simply be co-opted. But the other side of that is, we've rescheduled the site visit, and now, no kidding, if we want to do it, I got to go out and spring for these god-awful metatarsal boots. I feel like some sort of the environmental Imelda Marcos. If we can figure out a way to get gently wash the soles and because it. But see, the difference here is that, for instance, my friends and colleagues down in the Coal River Valley and down that way in southern West Virginia. Have been doing site visits for years down that way. Never ran up against this. And not a blessed thing to be said by the Department of Environmental Protection. Yeah. So we're still going to have to go and buy those damn boots. It's frustrating. It's truly because all, you know. We're just trying to get a handle on what's going on up there. And you know what? You should have seen. If there hadn't been what going on up above, what we knew was going on up above, it would have been a beautiful place. We went all the way down the mountain and all the way out past Golly Bridge and turned right and went through Belva and yada, yada, yada. Not that those names mean particularly anything to you. To get to the mine office. When we left, we just went straight on up the road we were on, and it crosses back over the mountain. Michael Kid A will remember the road. He was on it in November of 2008. He He wasn't on this side, though, but there's still some color, a lot of the yellows and the not so much of the reds and purples, but still a lot of color, autumn color in the hills. And it was beautiful. And it was like traveling, and we passed through what, for all intents and purposes, is a ghost town. There was a whole community there before the mountain was destroyed. People lived there for generations. But you can't live next to mountaintop removal and have anything like that would vaguely resemble the quiet enjoyment of your property. You know, one of those things that, for instance, right-wingers and libertarians get all head up about, quiet enjoyment. Well, that's from personal property, and I got a right to it. That's why we got American government. It's to protect my property. Only when it comes to mountaintop removal, sorry, the coal company has a greater right to your property than you do, and they can ruin your quiet enjoyment of it. And so you see houses that were built. Well, I just wanted to stop and just sort of feel. I know this is a little bit granola-ish. I just wanted to stop and sort of stand there and feel the vibes coming off of these places. Because they are places that housed generations. Maybe a grandpa, a ma, a dad, children. School buses went through there, rain or shine. The little road overarched by trees, gone yellow with the autumn on what was a pleasant, warm autumn morning. But now the houses' roofs? I don't know. But now the houses' roofs are sagging and caving in and falling in. And the weeds have overgrown the yards. And there are boards over the windows where the little general store used to be. And there is a tangible feeling of absence there. Scrub has grown up along the creek banks where once yards were closely tended and proudly maintained. What's the saying the old folks used to have around here? It ain't a sin to be poor, but it is a sin to be dirty. And they would work like mad to stay clean, even though a lot of them were working in underground mines back then. Lots of stories about daddies coming home and standing on the back porch and stripping buck naked because mama wouldn't have them dirty clothes in her clean house. Yeah. So that's what we drove through, and we climbed up over Gauley Mountain and came back down and just sort of ruminated on what we'd been through. It was an interesting morning, and we will do it again a week from today with safety glasses, gloves, hard hats, reflective clothing. They're going to get me into them damn Massey stripes one way or the other. Metatarsal boots. Bloused pants. Jeebus. A nice note coming in from Ray. The show is a great tribute to Gina and Judy as well as intellectual and spiritual freedom. Happy 6th birthday, Horn. Thank you, Ray. And another note going forward before we take any sort of a break or anything. Jay and Barb out in Oregon. Congratulations on the Horn's anniversary. Thank you for your unflagging efforts. Here's Wishing you the health and strength to continue walking the walk. Hope more will realize the critical importance of your work and help out financially. Thank you for all the inspiration you provide. At a time when it is so easy to become disheartened, we all need it. Thanks for being a rock, a river to your people. Our best to Agnes, the kids, and the entire Horn family, Jay and Barb. By the way, they add, NPR had a brief reference to Occupy Portland a couple of days ago. They reported a parole violator and a crackhead had been arrested at the protest. I'd about as soon light my money on fire as give it to NPR. Viva the Horn. Thank you. Thank you sincerely. And then this came in a couple of days ago from... from our buddy John in upstate New York. He said, I wanted to send you some thoughts on the Horn's birthday, along with a small contribution. So here it is. This isn't necessarily for broadcast. It's up to you. Well, it kind of, well, I just read it, and it is for broadcast. Because it's a beautiful, I truly love knowing what this cooperative, collective effort we make means in all its manifestations. John says, I've been listening for a decent chunk of your time on air. I started tuning in regularly via podcast in fall of 2007. As I've mentioned, I spent a good part of the time between 2007 and 2010 working in my lab, cleaning and typing and sorting artifacts from my dissertation research site. You can't imagine how mind-numbing that can become. Don't get me wrong, it was all interesting, and my mind was churning as I tried to make sense of 13,000 little bits of, well, trash from a century and a half ago. But once you've scraped dirt and rust off your 6,000th iron nail, it gets a bit tedious. The Horn got my mind turning in completely other directions, my blood racing. I laughed and cried along with everyone else in the little community. I'd caught your show earlier on Malloy's recommendation, but I never made a habit of listening. I'd tuned into Malloy, Peter Werby, and the old Majority Report, and I still catch the other folks sometimes, but your show has become part of my life. There are several reasons, I think. First of all, I love hearing a Southern accent talk progressive politics, where I come from, Southeast Texas originally. There's a joke that gay people are afraid to come out of the closet because other folks will think they're liberals. Let that one sink in for just a minute. It's the one blue county between Austin and Louisiana. Man, that's a lot of real estate. But even so, the politics are ugly. I've lived in Missouri and in Atlanta, too, and it's too easy to stereotype that accent as dirt, ignorant, and stupid mean. We both know that's not the whole story, so hearing your voice talk the way I think is bracing and rejuvenating. It's also refreshing to hear someone talk who's, well, smart. You have an inquisitive mind and a solid education, both formally and self-made, and crucially, you're not afraid to use them. I've got a brain and I'm not afraid to use it. Maybe that's a liner we need to cut. I don't know. I'm blushing here. Agnes is going to have to get the C-clamp out and squeeze my head back down to normal size. We seem, says John, to hate the idea of reason and critical thinking, or that history or politics or science is something you do, not something you learn. Reason and critical thought are missing from most of media, and they have a home at the Horn. But above all, I come to the Horn because of the community. It really is, as you say, conversation radio, unlike anything you've ever heard. Over the years, I feel like I've come to know people like Albert, Sandra, Juanita, the various and sundry Davids, Richard, Preston, Kevin, Luke, and the others that I'm leaving out for brevity, not lack of love. These other voices, free to travel down any conversational path they choose, are what sets the Horn apart, and they're what I treasure about the show. If I were to lose you, I'd be losing them also, and I honestly couldn't deal with that. The Horn can only exist in this form. I mean, it just wouldn't work on for-profit radio. This is a resource we need to nurture. Supporting the horn is supporting the idea that community is important, and I'm increasingly convinced that community can't grow alongside a balance sheet or shareholders report.
You know, I think I want to have that bronzed on something. Etched and bronzed.
I'm increasingly convinced that community can't grow alongside a balance sheet or shareholders report. Those things are the enemy of community. Supporting this community is a way to live what we preach, a way to be the media, a way to say no to ignorance and stupidity and the idea of profit at all costs.
I could say more, says John. Like how you've educated me about mountain removal, allowing me to become a small activist against the Appalachian apocalypse in my own ways, and the semantic difference between environmental rights and human rights. But I'll leave it here. Here's hoping for 6 more years. I intend to pitch in to see that that happens. Signed, John. Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Thank you very kindly, and thank you very kindly for the contributions that have rolled in the last few minutes. October's been kind of brutal. Thank you very kindly. Bob and Jay and Robert. Phase 5, Robert. Says, happy birthday to the horn. Your birthday present's in the PayPal. I have to head off to physio, so I'll catch the rest of the show on the podcast. Keep up the excellent work, and all my best to everyone. Thank you. Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you to Jay and Barb earlier. Ray wants to know, is it possible to hear the first show? Yes. If you go to the White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org, under the Horn Archives, you may have to drill back into a little bit deeper, but the first show is there. I ran a little bit of it last year. I'm just not up to running it. It's painful to listen to, you know, because I was a nervous wreck. I had gone off the air on June the 30th. Now we're going in a different direction. What direction's that? Whichever one you're not going in. Yeah, run off the air. And from July the 1st to October 24th, we worked tirelessly through Boss Man Wayne's vision and determination to set up the horn as a living memorial to his beloved wife, Gina, who had just passed away. We worked tirelessly to get this studio in and pull together everything necessary. Ben Birch even drove from Chicago. And David in Tennessee can tell you, because he was consulting even that far back, that by the time October 24th rolled around, I was scared stiff. I had worked myself into an absolute frenzy of fear. Granted, I'd come back to radio in 2003 after being away from it for 15 years. But in that intervening month, I was all see, and so, you know, you hear the musing, and you're hearing, is this thing on? Agnes was producing back then. Eventually, Agnes stopped producing, in large part because, frankly, the kids just couldn't be left to themselves for 3 hours at a time. You know, the sibling rivalry, they'd squabble and squawk, and a lot of chaos, homework not getting done, that kind of stuff. And so that left it after a couple of years. Well, it morphed into what it is here. You know, one guy, a microphone, and a mixing board. And a lot of chaos. But it's been a heck of a road, and I hope the road continues, how did Tolkien put it, ever onward? Yeah. Meanwhile, our pop culture correspondent, one of the Davids, David in Maine, says, let's not segue into Boot, Scoot, and Boogie.
or these boots are made for walking, or any Bootsy Collins tracks, please. You know, he, after all this time, he's learned how my sad and sorry little mind works. No, we're not going to do any of that. No, I've got something. Well, it's kind of a parody of what happened with Agnes and me last night. We don't get out a lot, Agnes and me, but we did head over last night for the because she's taken to traveling with Ferg and me, and helping out in producing the Prism chats. I think she misses this. Shh! Don't tell her I think so. She'd swear up and down she doesn't. But we don't get out a lot. But we went out last night. Got screwed out of $100 on boots, and we went out this morning. And well, you know, the couple that swears together stays together. Going up that lovely road through those overarching, beautifully turned autumnal leaves, and both of us, I can't believe those sorry, miserable black stag and who knows not pull Frazzleak and run us from mountain removers. God bless Dag and moving. Her saying it and me saying it, and Agnes doesn't miss much. I'm sitting there just trying to keep the blood down out of my neck and out of my face and trying to channel my inner Kwai Chang Khan or whatever, you know, ninja Shaolin monk don't start screaming obscenities self. And looking down at the shoes that don't have metatarsal supports in them on all the feet of all the DEP people, going, yeah, let's see. Yeah, one of these things does not belong. One of these things is not like the others. Agnes, meanwhile, is just quietly standing there looking around, sort of wide-eyed and innocent, and noticing that everything about us is being recorded and photographed. Pictures of the license plates, pictures of us, names, you know, the works. I certainly hope I don't come on air and tell you that another one of the automobiles has been sabotaged. Life in Appalachistan, what do you want? But we'll take a little break and come back. Lots of fun stories, because after all, you know, it's the middle of the week. It's prayer meeting Wednesday. Maybe we'll crank that up here in a couple of minutes. But it's also our sixth birthday. And again, thank you so very, very much for making it possible for the Horn to have a sixth birthday. You know the number. Lines are open. 877-443-2366. 877, numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. This is, in fact, America's listener-supported liberal voice for 6 years. This is The Horn.
We went out last night, like we swore we wouldn't do. Drank too much beer last night, a lot more than we wanted to. There were girls from Argentina and Arkansas, Maine, Alabama, and Panama, all mixed together and having a ball. Yeah, we went out last night. One thing started leading to another. Drunk on a dare, singing, I got you, babe, my Sonny and Cher. Your life was good everywhere. We went out last night. Well, you know I'm a music man. I grew up in East Tennessee, but last night I was everything. When I got a few drinks in me, I was a doctor, lawyer, senator's son, Brad Pitt's brother, and a man on the run. Anything I thought would get the job done. Yeah, we went out last night. One thing started leading to another.
started loving on each other. They were dancing on the tables and howling at the moon, tearing off together. And pretty soon there was not a soul in sight when we went out last night.
Yeah, it wasn't nothing like that when we went out last night. Just got, you know. Took a beating at Kmart and went on and did the Prism Chat. I'm just tickled to pieces. This has become a bit of a tradition, and I think I just really enjoy it. Horn Godfather, which is what I've called him for a long time, Mike Malloy, is with us now. Hey, Mike.
The Godfather, really?
Yeah, you're the Horns Godfather, man. The idea would not have happened without you.
I think you've told me this before, but I still find it a little bit strange or hard to believe.
Just a matter of driving around, whether it was through the connector in Atlanta or up and down the hills and hollers of West Virginia, listening to you on WLS, and then keeping up with you with IE America and stuff. And one day I just went, you know what? There's got to be somebody besides Mike out there.
There you go. Well, listen, I've got a song. Do you care if I sing this song?
No, not at all.
Okay. Me, 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 me. La, 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 la. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Horn. Happy sixth birthday to you. Didn't fit, but you get the idea.
But it worked out nicely, and you do that much better than I. I get emails telling me to shut up when I sing.
I hear that. This is your sixth
yes.
birthday? Oh, my God. You've been doing this on your own longer than I have.
Because y'all started,
We're in our third year. This is our third year being independent, but we haven't completed third year yet. I mean, we're in the third year, but so you're, if I'm the godfather, you're the grandfather. How's that?
Okay, that works out. We can meet over Sanko with our walkers.
Oh, no, my God, please, please.
Yeah, it's the Sanka that gets you, isn't it?
Right, it's the Sanka. You know, the walkers are fun. Actually, you can hit people with them, but, you know, it's that damn Sanka. So I've been trying to get this show together and watch Brian Williams here on NBC Nightly News. We talked about last night how the cops in Oakland were moving in, but I guess it was a hell of a mess. Here in Atlanta, it was a mess, too. There's no blood like there was in Oakland, but it's my understanding, Bob, that the Occupy people are coming back tonight, and the cops, in that inimitable way, are saying we're ready for them. It would be quite bizarre to me if the breakdown of civil disobedience and peaceful resistance occurred in Oakland. I mean, I wouldn't fault them. I'm just saying.
The irony was not lost on me, Mike.
Right.
When you consider the problems that, you know, with the BART killings and stuff like that that's gone on in Oakland, and of course its long history going back, you know, 40, 50 years, it wouldn't be surprising. But you know, what's almost more surprising is the fact that it almost looks like this is coordinated. And I don't mean to be all paranoid and tinfoil hat or anything, but, you know, when you've got these crackdowns coming in Oakland and Atlanta and the nastiness we saw in Boston, it's almost, well, it's reminiscent of that whole Gandhi thing about, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Is this stage three?
You know, I have a feeling that there has to be an element of that. I cannot believe that the mayors of these cities, whether they're big cities or not, are winging this. I'm sure there are phone calls going back and forth. I'm sure everybody has called Bloomberg. I know here in Atlanta that Kasim Reed, the mayor here in Atlanta, had some mixed feelings because this being the cradle of the civil rights movement. But he broke on Monday because, God forbid, there was a rap concert at Woodruff Park where the Occupy encampment is. And, you know, you're not supposed to have music, I guess, or you're not supposed to sing. I don't know what the hell the deal was. I think back to all the civil rights demonstrations that guaranteed that Kasim Reed someday could be mayor of Atlanta. And they did a lot of singing. They did a lot of tambourine shaking, a lot of drum beating. There has to be some kind, I think you're right, some kind of coordination, if nothing else, phone calls.
And that's kind of more than a little bit frightening, because as we saw in Oakland, this can devolve quickly into very, very dangerous situations.
Yeah.
And I was a kid when it happened, but it's hard to watch this stuff and not think about something like Kent State. You know, one rogue commander, you know, fire, and everything changes.
Well, I think that's the fear now. I know it's. I was talking to Kevin Zeese the other day, who started, or one of the core organizers of the October 2011 movement that I went to in D.C., and is now kind of merged and blended with the Occupy Washington movement. But we were talking about the horrific possibility of a protester, an occupier, being shot or killed or hit with a truncheon and dying of a clot on the brain. And I think this country is so volatile right now. We had a situation here at downtown at Woodruff Park the other night, right before the cops moved in, where somebody was walking around down there with an AK-47 strapped to his back. Now, who that was and what the point was, I can guarantee to you it was not somebody that was in the Occupy movement. But it's just like, you remember, when was it, a couple of summers ago, when they would have these town hall meetings and these freaks would show up with iron strapped to their waist, because they could, you know, walking around in a crowd with a semi-automatic assault rifles and high caliber handguns with, these huge magazines on them. And, you know, you look at that, you wonder, what the hell is going on? What is this? Are these a bunch of punks? And back then, I think it was. But I don't know. I hope that the right-wing crazy people don't think that because the demonstrators have committed themselves to nonviolence, that they're just going to sit there while people come in with clubs and start beating on them.
There's a big gap that exists, Mike, between, and I know you talk about it and we talk about it as well. There's a great big gap. Gulf between nonviolence and passivity.
Right, exactly.
Because the guy, you know, the guy who steps up to take his beating is exhibiting far more courage than any person with a gun or a truncheon will ever know.
That's right.
And I think, I don't know, maybe when the people on their couches begin seeing this, they'll understand that the order to go out and use rubber bullets and flash grenades on ordinary citizens being nonviolent, that's not the kind of order that comes from some lower middle class or middle class guy who still manages, or woman who still manages, to have a job in a plant somewhere. That comes from the 1%, doesn't it? I mean, there's no way to evade that.
No, you're absolutely right. The 1% are starting to, I think, they're certainly taking notice that this movement is not just suffocating on its own for lack of input of energy or oxygen or whatever. It continues. And that's usually when they call out. You know, let's not forget, I'm not talking now about the cop on the beat, but police departments are pretty much organized for the protection of property and for the protection of corporate interests. There has to be an orderly society for capitalism to work. Now, somebody can make an argument, well, there has to be orderly society for anything to work. Well, maybe so, but capitalism is a system that is designed to exploit, steal, rob, lie, cheat, and there has to be a powerful policing force. Either it is a public police force, like most cities have, or it's a private force, like Blackwater, in order to maintain the proletariat to not stick its head up too high and say, wait a minute, you're cheating me, you're lying to me, you're taking from me, you're taking from my grandchildren. So I think in all these cities where the police are starting to react, the reaction is coming from several places, not the least of which is their training. They're trained, you know, this business about to protect and defend, okay. And again, I'm not talking about the cop on the beat, but when you have big city police who move in, as you point out, on unarmed people and tell them that, okay, your First Amendment demonstration of your First Amendment rights of assembly and speech and petition the government is over at 9 o'clock, so get out of here. Just like George Bush in his First Amendment zones. And you and I both know that this country was designed, the whole country, to be a First Amendment zone. So there's some crap going on, and I said last week, just my little radio program with my 38 listeners, and I said, you know, I know nobody of any importance is listening, except maybe Bob Kincaid, but I said to the authorities out there, you better understand something. If you push this movement the wrong way and it explodes in your face, there's going to be an explosion that I don't think this country's ever seen before.
I think you're absolutely right, Mike, and, you know, we have a little thing that we do every couple of weeks. We do an American history chat with a PhD American history professor who has a grant to teach teachers how to teach American history better, and we do the video and the audio here on the Horn so more people can have access to it. And you get there's so much American history that people don't know, and there, a couple of weeks ago there was this one little thing that Dr. Bill, that's his name, Dr. Bill O'Brien, handed to me that just blew me away. Because he is an expert in how the Constitution came into being. And one of the things he pointed out to me, because he's got this growing body of information that suggests that the Constitution was never intended to promote democracy. Democracy is a word we throw around like motherhood and apple pie without really understanding the underpinnings of it. And he told me that in his correspondence, John Adams had suggested that the best way to keep the United States of America from ever becoming a democracy was to create a state centered and founded upon law and order and property rights.
Mm.
You know, so there was a dichotomy there from the very beginning. And maybe one of the things that people are beginning to figure out is that you cannot have anything that we understand as democracy and have it exist coincidental to this predatory economic system that, for lack of a better word, we call capitalism.
Right, right. Well, I completely agree. I think the point your professor made is very salient. It's something that I didn't know, but that's one reason I like talk radio, is because you're always learning something. But I think that point is one that should be taught in the schools, and I think people should understand that.
And part of this Occupy process, I think, is the byproduct of an entire generation that was deprived. I mean, because we saw it in the school systems. I graduated in the early 80s from high school. I had civics. The kids who graduated 2, 3, 4 years after me didn't. They didn't. And so this is a desire, this is a manifestation of a desire on the part of a generation that's substantially younger in large part than you or I to actually participate in their government. It's brilliant to see them, you know, people talk about their clunky decision-making process. Well, that's okay, because the first thing they're doing is building community. And once they work out community, they'll work out the rules of, and you know, for some smart ass banker in the corner penthouse of a tower, to say, well, you know what, they haven't given us any solutions. You know, screw them.
right, and they won't identify their leadership.
Right. You know, one of the things I was thinking about it the other day, Mike, and it just made me want to scream, because I remember a while back hearing about one of those hedge fund venture capital firms. It was called Prometheus Holdings. Cerberus.
Cerberus, the beast, the Egyptian animal that would eat you if you.
The nine-headed dog that ate people at the gates to Hades. You know how? I don't know if they mean to be this Freudian, but they certainly are. But you know, I mentioned that guy in the corner office. If you want, Mike, a picture postcard of the 1%, it is literally true that former Vice President of the United States, Dan Quayle, occupies one of those corner offices in Cerberus Holdings.
Oh, my God.
And I mean, there's the one. They're not that bright.
No. No, they're not. I have yet to meet one of these people. I haven't met that many, but I have yet to meet one or hear one speak in the so-called 1% who, you know, had the sense God gave a sack of doorknobs. It's so infuriating because you don't have to be a very bright person to learn how to game this predatory capitalism to work exactly for you. And hey, listen. I gotta go.
I know you've got a show to prep for, and
yeah.
I'll be in the chat room later. And thanks for all the years, and thanks for the inspiration.
Well, back at you. I mean, you know, it's nice to know there's somebody out there is loony, if that's the right word, as I am, because nobody else, you know, none of these other liberal talk show hosts ever take the risk that you take or that I take, and I know that. So it's nice to know that there is a bit of company out there. I'm sure that you sometimes think the same thing. So
it can get a little strange up here in the hills and the hollers.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, you're up there where they could. Well, you know, I live in the foothills of North Georgia Mountains, where they might could take a shot at me if they could ever figure out who I am. But you're out there all the time. I mean, you have to be careful. I don't know why you don't carry a shotgun or something with you. Boy, I would not.
Well. There's actually one in the corner of the studio, Mike, in case they ever come through the door.
I wouldn't be surprised, so you be careful too, pal.
All right, Mike Malloy, thank you very, very much. Say hi to Kathy and Molly for us. And, by the way, a beautiful job at October 2011 in D.C.
Thanks.
I hope you and I get a chance to, I hope to get be your wheelman again sometime.
Well, hey, we'll do it. Tara was there. She didn't need to bail me out this time, but Pterodactyl from
she's just awesome.
RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. That's her website. She was there and edited that video and put in the I don't know if you've seen the latest one. I just put it up last night, but it's also at YouTube. But that's Tara's work. It's also at RepublicanDirtyTricks.com, and it's also, I think, at TVNewsLies.org. But Tara put some music and some cutaways into that 8-minute video that impressed the hell out of me. I sent her an email, said, "Dear God!" Of course, that's her business. She does video graphics and stuff, but as well as being a comedian, stand-up comedian in New York. But anyway, she said, "Next time I see you, to tell you hi."
Oh, wonderful.
Eventually, the three of us to get together and raise some more hell like we did in D.C.
I sure hope it happens.
Back in March, I guess. All right, take it easy, Bob, all right?
All right, you have a great show and a great night, and thanks, Mike.
All right, man, take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You know, I listened to Mike for a lot of years before I ever got to meet him for the first time on the cruise last February, and eternal thanks to the... what was the phrase Fancy used the other night? We were scholarshipped. Eternal thanks for the person who kindly contributed to us being able to go on that trip. It will never be forgotten. And that's when I first got to meet Mike. I got to hang out with him again in D.C. last May. No, March, April. Time flies, suffice to say. And I hope we get to do it again sometime soon because, you don't get any. What you hear on the radio is the guy Mike is. And Mike is the guy who you hear on the radio. I mean, vice versa. I thought the first time I met Mike about that line from To Kill a Mockingbird where Atticus says, "I have to be the same man at home than I am in town. Otherwise, it's all for naught." And that is Mike Malloy up and down. And the kindness he has shown the horn over the years in recommending us to his listeners, his truth seekers. Yeah, 38 listeners. Sure, Mike. You got that many? No. In recommending the horn to the truth seekers. Can never be overestimated or appropriately thanked. It's about 5 minutes past the hour. You want to get in on the conversation? You are more than welcome to. It's Wednesday, it's midweek, and yet somehow it feels oddly like a Monday here. We'll take a little break. I never play this song because it's Mike's, but, you know, Mike was just here, so why not?
This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Kathy. Hi, Molly.
My name. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Bubble Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And don't care about that body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
You know, Kate just reminded me, or not reminded me, she just wrote and said, you know, I'd never heard that song all the way through. And, you know, that's Mike's Friday sign-off. I think it used to be his every night sign-off. But it's a Friday sign-off. The name of the band is Driving and Crying, and that is just a brilliant piece of music. It's called I'm Going Straight to Hell. And I figured y'all might like to hear it all the way through, too. Maybe play it about once a year. I think I've maybe played it 2-3 times in the program as a whole. And it means so much to get that call from Mike that... I'm not kidding when I say that he was the inspiration behind my side of doing this, my decision to go back into radio. Hearing so much right-wing stuff, and the only liberal I could ever hear, progressive, whatever word we want to use, was Malloy. And it literally became a matter of, you know, I wanted to add to the quantum of somebody pushing back against those, you know, evil bastards. And so, 6 years later, we find ourselves here. Okay? Yeah. Email from our buddy Kevin in China. The subject line, this is where the coal ends up. He's talking about China, of course. A lot of Appalachia winds up in China. It winds up in Russia. It winds up in India. Because Appalachia, which was for so long a resource colony for the United States, has now, we've been either upgraded or downgraded, depending on how you look at it, and we're a resource colony for the whole world now.
and we pay for it with our lives. It's just a fact. To give you an idea, I said we might talk about it later, and we, yeah. Monday night, I had the opportunity to sit in with a number of other affected people from Appalachia, including my dear friends Bo Webb and Maria Gano and Debbie and Vernon from Coal River Mountain Watch, and a number of other individuals who got to sit down and tell the head man from the EPA's Region 3, which encompasses West Virginia, a very simple message. You have to stop this. You have to stop this. This is no longer a debate in good faith between some people who say we don't like it and other people who say, but it makes us money. The data are now in. What is going on in Appalachia is killing people. We are paying with our lives for their profits. You heard the way Malloy described the way capitalism works? You have to steal from somebody. You have to abuse somebody. You have to oppress people. Lots and lots of people. Well, the poster child for runaway capitalism is mountaintop removal. Because what has been suspected, what people who had to deal with it on the downslope side from these godforsaken affairs, has now been entered into the halls of documented reality. It's killing people. It's destroying lives. It's putting children in early graves. As my buddy Bo Webb pointed out, you know, a coal miner has MSHA, and maybe he's got a union. He's got all kinds of structures around him to try to protect him. You know, it was just yesterday that the United Mine Workers of America, who, if they could only organize more mountaintop removers, would happily... I mean, they already advocate for mountaintop removal. The United Mine Workers of America are actively involved in seeking the destruction, the death, the decimation, the devastation of my family and all the families in Appalachia who'd live near this god-awful nightmare. So don't get all squishy and wishy-washy about the UMWA on me. They got nothing for them. But they issued a report yesterday on the Upper Big Branch disaster that killed 29 miners inside that hellhole that was then operated by Don Run Coal, Work Like You Mean It Blankenship. And one phrase emerged from that report. The United Mine Workers report referred to the Upper Big Branch disaster as industrial homicide. And they use that term to describe 29 miners killed on the job. What term do you use to describe the hundreds, if not the thousands, of people, and they are thousands, who have died as a direct and proximate result of the coal industry's merciless and remorseless quest for greater and higher profits, no matter the cost? What do you call that? And, of course, being a bureaucrat, the EPA guy was, well, we'll certainly do the best we can. And, you know, and we just said, no, no, no. Either you say you will use the power that is given you by the law to put this to an end, or you are part of the problem. Do you want to be that? This is a bright line moment. Can you, for the rest of your life, which looks to be, you know, we hope will be long, can you continue to look in the mirror to shave and say, I am a part of a process that is killing innocent people? Can you do that? But then again, it's also, I'm also reminded of the thing that remains my subject line on emails that I send. And that line from Kurt Vonnegut. A normal person functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. Even looking squarely at himself in the mirror to shave.
David in Tennessee heard what Mike was saying and agreed. He said, remember me saying our collective movement wouldn't really put power to the drive wheels unless there were bodies in the streets? Thought so. We are closer, much closer. And hence what I said about stage three. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. We are in stage three. When it's some mama's or daddy's child on the streets that's being rendered bloody or deafened by a rubber bullet or a flash grenade, they'll be out in the streets too. This thing has tremendous potential, and I hope that it succeeds. I support it. And we know that they are afraid. Another story. Some right-wing jackasses were caught moving through the Occupy Wall Street crowd. No kidding. Literally giving out bongs and Che Guevara rolling papers. No kidding. And when pressed, they admitted, well, yeah, we did that because we were hoping that we might get some good footage to run on Fox. That says a mouthful. But no, Monday night we were confronting that individual with our reality. Not our theories. Not our hypotheses. It is no longer a hypothesis that this is killing us. It's reality. We've put people in the dirt that we know would not be there but for the remorseless, relentless drive for greater and higher profits that motivates the coal industry. Anyway, as I said, Kevin wrote in from China. He said, first off, happy anniversary and sorry to add salt to the wound of mountaintop removal. However, we working people's fight is a universal fight, and that is so true. They literally die by the thousands in Chinese coal mines every year, workers. And Chinese mothers and Chinese babies breathe filthy coal smoke day in and day out, and they die early and often. What is not okay to do to me here and my family here in Appalachia is not okay to do to somebody in Wyoming or Montana or southern Illinois or China or Tibet or Mongolia or Bangladesh or India. If there's ever going to be, and I said this before, if there's ever going to be a thing that follows capitalism once capitalism has absolutely collapsed, and collapse it will. Yeah, now this is not me, I don't have my Che Guevara t-shirt on now. But it will collapse. All human institutions do. It will not evolve simply because its structure does not permit evolution. It is, the entire thing is premised on devolution because it is consumption-based. But if we are ever to have whatever comes next, if it is to succeed and we are to continue living on this planet, it will have to have in it an element of regard for the people who are displaced and destroyed when things like coal are dredged out of the earth. It will have to have a recognition, a component that recognizes that coal is no longer an acceptable energy use. You know, President Not Sure today threw a sop to, or maybe yesterday, threw a sop to the people who are crying out against the Keystone XL pipeline. Well, it's under review and we're looking at it and no decisions have been made. This, of course, will trigger a right-wing backlash response of people, right-wingers screaming full-throated as they scrape their little knuckles on the ground that Obama, the socialist Marxist with anti-colonial Kenyan tendencies and the Muslim, wants us to all freeze in the dark.
Trust me, their lines are already scripted. I would just as soon he had said nothing to them. Say nothing. And then, can it? As it is now, the right wing will dog whistle its adherents to bring pressure to bear on him, and poor sad President Not Sure can't stand no pressure. We've seen that time and again. So it is incumbent on us to keep the pressure up on the Keystone XL pipeline and mountaintop removal and the Marcellus Shale so that we can't be screamed down by the profit mongers. I'm going to get Kevin's email read yet, or I'm going to bust in the process. He says, the We Working People's fight is a universal fight. This is where much of the coal ends up, China. Kevin continues, the treatment of the workers at Foxconn Technologies in China, in which the conditions were so horrible, many of the workers committed suicide as a form of protest. The Foxconn issue is a travesty against the rights of workers, and my heart goes out to the dead workers and their families. However, there is a flip side to this issue. My girlfriend, who is a South African citizen, and I, a U.S. citizen, have been living in China for almost 8 months and have been dealing with the Chinese on a daily basis. And I know that knowing Kevin, that this comes from a place of humanity and love and respect. But he's writing about his realities. And he says, the truth of the matter is the kinder and more humanely you treat many of the Chinese people, the more they resent you. If you treat them with kindness and respect, they will view you as being weak and unprofessional, especially if you are a foreigner, and even more so if you are a non-white foreigner. You cannot simply ask for something. You have to order or demand it, or you will not get it. Both my girlfriend and I are foreign English instructors, and in our classes, we often have to yell at our students in an unprofessional manner in order to get any level of cooperation from them. In my case, adult students, and if you don't, they will often complain to our supervisors about our competence as teachers. Also, to top that off, I've even yelled at my supervisor a few times in order to maintain a level of respect. My girlfriend and I hired a lady to clean our apartment. We started out paying her twice the going rate, which is about 30 RMB an hour. We were told to pay her 15 an hour. That's about $3. She often did a bad job. Now I'm paying her the going rate, and she's greatly improved her performance. Keep in mind, if I was Chinese, I would only be paying her 7 RMB an hour. We asked a very westernized Chinese friend of ours, why do so many of the Chinese act in this manner? And she explained to us, this is what many Chinese expect from authority. We being teachers, we are very high authority figures in China. Many Chinese just seem to respect more the foreigners that mistreat them. This self-loathing, I suspect, comes from centuries of a certain kind of Confucian thinking and decades of Maoism. It's precisely what it is, Kevin. This is why upon our arrival to South Africa, we will never set foot in a Walmart, the world's largest distributor of Chinese-made goods. Also, we will try as much as possible not to buy Chinese goods regardless of the financial consequences. We do not want that kind of blood and suffering on our hands. Even though things for my girlfriend and myself are going quite well professionally here, as people of conscience, we cannot stay in China and continue to live and act this way towards our fellow human beings. In truth, I resent having to act this way in order to survive here in China. Therefore, after our contracts end in the spring of 2012, we will not be signing on for a second year and will be teaching English in some other part of the globe. Your friend always, Kevin and Andrea in Shanghai. P.S. We do owe you so much in the form of contributions. You owe us, you owe nothing, Kevin. No one owes for any of this. No one owes. We all work together to pull this together, to make this go so that we can all have it. To owe presupposes a debt, and there is no debt. But he does add, China does not make it easy to send money outside of the country. A fascinating picture. I remember Kevin's disillusionment with the United States that led him first to Korea and then to China. And it must be horrifying to run up against that kind of mindset. But bear in mind, you know, there was an old saying in the Soviet Union back in its days, among the working class, as long as they pretend to pay us, we'll pretend to work. I suspect there's more than a little bit of that in what Kevin is running up against. More than a little. Thank you for your note, Kevin. Mark, writing in from Florida, the United the mine workers need to organize solar panels and wind turbine builders if they love their states. Organize the future and not the death-filled past. Union worker Mark, happy birthday, Horn. And it gives me no pleasure to say that I've written off the United Mine Workers. So much good came of their efforts in the early part of the 20th century and past the halfway mark of the 20th century. But eventually they decided to get in bed with the coal companies rather than stand as a bulwark for workers. And that's not just me saying this. You can talk to retired and some active UMWA workers, and they'll tell you the same damn thing. And the United Mine Workers, in an effort to get other members, they have organized nurses. They organized a Remington firearms factory in Massachusetts. But no, Mark, and I hate to say this, no, Mark, they will never organize a solar plant. They will never organize workers who put in wind turbines because they are committed to that rock of death. And that's just sad. Jim writing in, Bob, we go back a long way. We've agreed to disagree on many occasions. However, I wish you and others supporting your efforts to alleviate suffering humanity all of my best. Sincerely, Jim. Thank you. Thank you very kindly, Jim. I think we've agreed more than we've disagreed. So just a little view of the mailbag. And lines open if you want to jump in. Don't wait until the last 30 minutes of the program and then fill up all six lines, okay? We've been doing a pretty good job of getting to all the calls, but we got to have, you got to be, the, you, yeah. You know the number, okay? So let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, if I haven't already done so, happy birthday to you.
Well, thank you, Reverbo. Not happy birthday to me, but to the horn.
No trick, exactly. But hey, I'll give you a ding too.
Ooh, a birthday ding.
There you go, birthday ding. You know, your dismay with the United Mine Workers kind of leads me into one of the things I want to talk to you about. Because I thought this time around, we were going to have more participation in this revolt. I thought the unions and the civil servants and the public servants, and I thought there were going to be a lot more people realizing they were on the same side of the issue here, you know, than they were before. So is this just a bunch of lip service or what? Because you remember in the 60s, when you look back on it, that was an opportunity I think missed, and maybe legitimately missed, because you know the unions for some reason they were so hawkish, you know, they were so pro-war,
yeah,
that they were never going to be invited into the anti-war movement because they didn't want to be. But this time, this is a revolt against money, right? This is everybody's fed up with how money corrupts.
And you know, some of them have been making the right noises. Granted, Richard Trumka, head of this AFL-CIO, doesn't need to go to Occupy Wall Street, but he's been making the right noises about it. The head of the United Steelworkers, name disappeared, has been making all the right noises.
Yeah.
But there's more. But that's one of the fundamental problems that occurs within the labor movement. Is that, one, they spend all of their money on politics and political campaigns. And when they're not spending their money on that, you can ask my good friend Rick Smith. He can tell you that they spend more money on donuts and packages of sunflower seeds every year than they do supporting media that supports them. And so I guess one answer, Reverbo, is they still don't get it.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe the rank and file of these diminishing organizations is still so easily, conned by that word, jobs.
Jobs. That's J-A-W-B-Z, by the way. Jobs.
That's right. Well,
And remember, too, Reverbo, historically, the people who would have been inclined to support something like Occupy Wall Street were largely driven out of the movement en masse during the Red Scare. Remember the Red Scare followed by the organized crime thing. Those two things were used to drive out anybody with a so-called leftist agenda out of the labor movement, and replaced with hardline rightward leaning apparatchiks. And that's how it got to that place that you described, where, you know, yeah, let's bomb some more rice paddies, hot diggity damn. That's how that happened. Not all unions, but a whole bunch of them.
How easily the chumped get conned.
Overchumped.
Boy, oh boy. And speaking of con jobs and chumps, seeing as it could be a prayer meeting Wednesday. And the other day, I was listening to something or other, and then that old light bulb went off, and this one is a classic. This one is one of the most profitable propaganda campaigns ever perpetrated on the chumps. And it simply is this: the only way to be a good Christian is to vote Republican.
Well, everybody knows that, Reverbo.
Jesus, man, that had worked so well. Oh, man. Oh,
it almost hurts to contemplate.
It does.
But again, that's not to sound like a broken record or anything, Reverbo. But that happened that way consciously. I remember Peter Godbold, since it's anniversary night, I remember Peter Godbold going on at length describing this one particular organization. Oh, God, what was the name of it? Whose sole purpose was to infiltrate Protestant fundamentalist Christianity and turn them rightward. And they started with the Baptists and worked on the Methodists, and they got a bunch of the Presbyterians, mm-hmm. and subverted the message of, you know, that brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer into this idea of Jesus as capitalist. I mean, I suspect you've walked into a couple of churches here and there, Reverbo. Can you wrap your head around capitalist Jesus, really?
You know, about the closest I got was when I thought I was going to join the Unitarians, but I was just looking for girls.
We've all been there.
Because that's about as close as I could ever get to it.
But if you're going to troll a church for the potential soulmates, I'd say the Unitarian Church would be a good place to look.
I thought so, but, well, that's a story for another time. Not, as Peter Sellers would say, not a pretty story if you must know. I mean, if you have been tortured, oh, never mind. And there's another one. They, again, another one that works so well against the chumps. It just got, that one just worked like a charm. It's still working, not as well maybe as it did before, but. It is still most alive. Well, now here's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. Are cops everywhere thugs? Is that just the way it is and the way it's going to be?
You know what? When they're on the beat, they're not. But when you put them behind those anonymous black ops SWAT uniforms, yeah, that turns them into thugs.
I mean, aren't they really trying to, though, get in the, they're supposed to be kind of a nonpartisan peacekeeping civilian group. And it seems like it just gets, I don't want to hear that anymore. They're not nonpartisan at all. They so frequently get very partisan. And to me, it's a very political statement when you go the extra mile to start being real rough with the peaceful demonstrators. While you stand back with your arms crossed, the teabag rallies when the skinheads bring the guns. That's very political to me. When you're roughing up women who are just standing there doing nothing, and you're kind of winking at them.
I think there is a sort of sociocultural.
I expected more from the cops at this point.
Yeah, but there's a sociocultural thing going on. cops don't know. Cops, you know, if you see a bunch of teabaggers with AK-47s on their shoulders, you know how to respond to them if you're a cop, because if they unlimber that gun off their back, then you can shoot them down. But with a bunch of peaceful, nonviolent protesters, and they're not really doing anything. That I think, and this is not a defense by any stretch of the imagination, Reverbo, but I think there's got to be a certain amount of cognitive dissonance. Yeah, you want me to what? Well, okay. I mean, as long as nobody can see my badge number or my name, and I'm hidden behind a mask, and I've got a shield and a big stick, yeah, what the hell? Let's break some skulls.
But you're getting political there, though. You're not, suddenly you're going the extra mile with the peaceful folks. I don't, you know, and that goes back to, I thought we were going to have a little more, look, being a cop in these situations, admittedly, you're in a tough spot. I mean, you've got to protect and serve, as they say. I used to be in law enforcement. I knew these guys. I mean, women, too. But there were a lot, I mean, I don't know who's listening right now, but I'll just tell you, I didn't see a whole lot of evolution with some of these guys. They were just the bullies in high school, a lot of them that just wanted to be cops. Now they're growing up cops.
Right, and let's bear in mind, let's think about a cop salary. It ain't big.
It's a soldier's salary, and everybody's surprised when soldiers kind of go off.
Right.
Act crazy.
So you take a guy who, or woman, who's got a high school education, and you run them through a 6-week course at best. I mean, now I'm talking about West Virginia here. This is how it works. At best, you run them through a 6-week course in copping at the State Police Academy, and then you turn them loose with a really powerful automobile, a firearm, and the full authority of the on-the-ground enforcement of the law, and that ain't going to yield some problems? You know, that's one of that's one of the reasons that the cops here have sort of worked up a program where you can take, where an officer can take his years on the force, take a couple of online courses, and they'll give him a master's degree in criminal justice so that they can say, well, you know, our cops are highly educated.
Nice. There were some police departments when I lived in Colorado, some that you had to have a college degree, I think, but there were few and far between. And really, what does that prove? I mean, I've been to college, you know, enough said. But, I was just disappointed. I'm disappointed that you can't, that you have to pepper spray a woman holding a baby in her face. You have to do things like that. You know, and the necks can parade around with their,
AK-47s and grenade launchers and.
Right, because we're glad we live in a country where all that can happen. Somehow, that's why we're so glad.
Well, you know, we're just... I think Lee Greenwood said it best, Reverbo.
Oh, God. Oh, don't do this.
I'm glad to live in a country where at least I know I'm free.
There you go.
Of course, how free one is when the flashbang grenades are going off, or the tear gas is in your nose and your lungs and your eyes, or the rubber bullet has just laid you out and you spent a couple of, you managed to, now that just beats the pants off of me, Reverbo. Imagine, you survived a couple of tours in Iraq, IEDs and all that fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you survived a posting to a forlorn and forgotten place in far Afghanistan, somewhere up in the Hindu Kush, where everybody hated you. You survived all that, and you came home, Reverbo, and because, you know, you're a returning Marine who has served your country, and because you're a little worried about the country that you were told you were fighting and serving to protect, you go down to Occupy Oakland, and you're at home in America, and you take a rubber bullet in the chest and you're knocked to the ground and you're bleeding and people are screaming, medic, medic, trying to get to you. And the cops are still lobbing flash grenades at you. Now that's, you know, we talk from time to time, Reverbo, about those little signposts on this little road that we're on that's obviously not a maglev train. The little Burma shave signs to America's dystopian future. Well, that ain't a sign, Reverbo. That's a damn billboard. Sorry, wasn't yelling at you.
That was wonderful. I don't even have a response to that.
And in the main, the whole point is I don't either.
I know. Well, you know, in the middle of that, all I could think of was the cost of war and the cost of violence and the cost of dysfunction heading into the trillions. All I thought about was just this whole country is just mentally ill.
Yeah, by the way, I just as if some sort of miracle out of the ether, a little tap on the shoulder from the universe, as you and I were discussing this, I got an email in, of course, it was from Move On, but still, and of course, there it is. Last night, but even as we were discussing this, this came in from Move On. Of course, it purports to give you a little bit of information, but what it is actually is a solicitation for donations. Last night, Scott Olson, a Marine who served two tours in Iraq, was struck in the head by a non-lethal projectile fired by the Oakland police. The round fractured his skull, leaving him in critical condition. He had joined with other members of Occupy Oakland to peacefully protest the group's eviction that morning. When a group gathered to help Olson after he was hit, a police officer threw a flashbang grenade into the group from a few feet away. Can you click here to chip in? You know, I mean,
I'm a real peaceful person, and I avoid confrontation almost at all costs. But at some point, that's going to light the fuse for somebody. And, you know, let's not kid ourselves here. You and I, everybody knows where the real threat is not from these people. The real threat in the last 20 years or so has been offered on the extreme right. Those are the folks they got to watch out for.
Well, from their personal safety standpoint, absolutely. But again, I go back to the fact that when one of those freaks pulls out the AK-47, you know what to do.
Yeah, you mow them down.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, let me take that a step further, Reverbo. You talk about the people they got to watch out for. Well, and there's the people we've all got to watch out for. And because, you know, the right-wingers who were showing up at town hall meetings carrying their guns and grenade launchers and, you know, I got me a howitzer on a trailer. Well, I drove my tank. You know, those assholes. This is not sympathy, but it's a manifestation or at least an acknowledgement on my part of reality. Those people are manipulated. And here's a hint, we're not manipulating them. Again, it's the 1%, and maybe the 1% isn't even an accurate term. It's the 0.4%. It's 400 families.
Mm-hmm.
And all the manipulation is flowing from them, and it's them we got to watch out for.
Well, and their Trump army. Their Trump domestic army.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're Trump troops.
Yeah, well, while these cops are, you know, snickering about, you know, kicking people who are doing yoga in the street, you know, Tim McVeigh is going to a meeting as they snicker.
Give yourself a bell for that.
Well, can you, like, tell with a bell, by the way?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
I mean, can we say that again? While these guys are kicking people doing yoga in the streets, Tim McVeigh is going to a meeting. Jesus, I wish that would fit on a bumper sticker.
It's too long for a bumper sticker.
But no, that's tonight's moment of profundity.
Well,
I know you're self-effacing and you're loath to accept something like that. But
right.
Yeah, that's so far past toasters. I mean, Jesus, that's the full-on convection oven for tonight, Reverbo. It just is.
Wow. I get to come down out of the isolation booth and pick up the keys to my new convection oven.
You're damned right. That thing will do a pizza or a rotisserie chicken in under 10 minutes.
Wow. Yeah, wait. So,
got dual exhausts, chrome-plated mud flaps, flames on the side.
Oh, boy. Two steering wheels. It's a possibly even more than one engine.
It does convection and microwave at the same time. I mean, we weren't expecting that for at least another century.
So can we say that the Vietnam protest, would you agree that they gathered more steam when they got more upper-class participation, when the upper class was affected too, like a senator's kid might get drafted, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Because all, you know, no revolution ever succeeds until the middle class gets involved. Because until the middle class gets involved, you can just mow down the poor folks.
Right, because they're just, right, they're unsanitary. You can't do worse. But I was just thinking, so here we are, you know, all the money is now at the top. All the, thanks to Citizens United, you can buy legislation and you can buy democracy even more than you ever could before. And so I'm going to leave you with this. Hopefully there's some other people want to wish you a happy birthday. So my question is then, the big social and economic movements do start or bottom up, but at some point you've got to have somebody at the top. And my question is, so do we have anybody at the top?
I think there's a lot of people who could conceivably be deemed that, but the problem with people at the top is that they tend to be self-appointing. And at this point, this thing is so horizontal, and that is the profound difference between, say, anti-Vietnam stuff and the present, is the horizontal quality of the way it's happening, because it really is, as far as I can tell, and I'm certainly subject to being really wrong. It is trying to be decidedly leaderless. It doesn't want a Gandhi or a Dr. King. Because when you advance, you know, theoretically, when you advance one, it's like algebra. You know, both sides of the equation have to balance. If you advance one, you're diminishing the other. And it wants to speak with one voice, and I can't be condemnatory of that. Now,
no, it's clearly a grassroots organized thing. But I start thinking about that Richard K. Morgan quote that we are so fond of, that paragraph about how you have to make them really afraid of you. You have to make it, you know, make it personal, whatever. But you have to, you know, at some point, and I'm saying all the money and all the power is now so narrowly focused. They're not, I mean, well, these people, Goldman Sachs at this moment, I don't think really gives a shit one way or another if there's anybody down, you know, eating pizza, yelling at them from below. But you don't think that eventually you're going to need like a George McGovern or a Martin Luther King or somebody like this
Someone will likely arise, and I don't think it's going to be any of the usual suspects. It ain't going to be Michael Moore, and I love Michael Moore. It's not going to be any politician that we recognize, because the movement itself seems wholly disillusioned with all politics. Whether or not that is correct is subject to interpretation and subject to discussion.
You need a Ralph Nader type, I think.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. This thing will raise someone up. If there is a voice out there that you're hearing more of and who is elaborating and elucidating on what this really means, probably more intelligently than anybody else, you and I already know who that is. Because you send me his articles. Chris Hedges.
Chris Hedges, okay. For a minute, I was, God, it could be 100.
No, but I mean, Chris Hedges is doing a better job of explaining this to people on couches if they could only hear his voice. I got to get Chris on the phone or something one of these days. I bitch and complain about how much time it takes, but some people are worth getting on. Chris is one of them. And just, you know, try to brainstorm a little bit out of that. He is by far a more effective spokesperson for what the aims and goals are and the underlying reasons are behind all of this than anybody I've read. Because, frankly, and I want to go ahead and say this with you on the line so that you can either call me down or give me an amen. I needed that information that we just got in a moment ago about Scott Olson. I needed that badly, and it just popped into my email box, so I can't be too critical of that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But damn it, Reverbo. There is no, I mean, how can I say this? Because, you know, I fundraise too. We fundraise. Because it is a collective effort. But I would never sit here and do a 15-minute discussion on what happened in Oakland, and then finish it by saying, "And could you hit the PayPal button, please?" That's a pitch too far for me.
That's a tough one, all right.
And frankly, it pisses me off that that's what I got from Move On, and I think that's why Move On has been getting some pushback from the likes of Chris Hedges. Because they're part of, you know, they have become, and look, I'm not singling out Move On. It's happening all over the place. And everybody's saying, you know, I've seen emails, you know, "We have brought you unbiased coverage of Occupy Wall Street. Will you please click our donate button?" God damn, can't they lay off it for a minute?
Maybe it's just the overtness of it that's so offensive, because I'm telling you, you got to get those contributions. They can come in covertly for me, but they got to come.
And
maybe,
so
maybe,
I mean,
maybe you're just wishing. But you're look at you here. The truck needs tires.
No, that's a transmission. The truck needs a transmission. It's got tires. It died the day after it got tires.
Right, and the roof's leaking, and the whole family needs gallbladders, and somehow you've been doing this for 6 years from Possum Land, and that's pretty damn amazing. And I hope you go another 6 years. But, you know, our side has got to get, there's only one way to get the power, and that's at the moment to play to be players. And then you can change the game.
Yeah, you know, in regard to your question, Reverbo, I know you said you need to go, but I don't mean to make you hang on and on and on. But I got a note in from David in Tennessee, subject, the quote-unquote one. "Whoever it is that rises up," David says, "will be for real what we thought Barack Obama would become."
Yes, yes.
And it's hard not to make that observation. You know, this could be his moment, but it ain't. Now, you know, they're doing some good things with student loans. I mean, that's a direct response to stuff that has been said by Occupy Wall Street. It is not a full-on debt jubilee, which is a biblical term meaning the eradication of all debt that, you know, the right-winger's God says you're supposed to do every however many years and is unequivocal about it. But it's a start, because the Obama administration has accelerated a program from beginning in 2014 to beginning in 2012 that will allow people crippled by student debt to consolidate all of their loans into one payment that will be federally guaranteed instead of at the mercy of for-profit banksters.
What's not to like?
Right. Now, will he get 10 cents worth? Will he get 10 cents worth of credit? No, I'll get 15 emails tomorrow telling me he's a fascist.
Well, and also, I mean, you want to raise the river or lower the bridge? I mean, tuition is just obscenely expensive for a bachelor's degree that will barely get you a job at Burger World. But you can't, that's what I was saying, like we were talking about before. But so we can't. That'll have to come later. Right now, you know, there's fixes that are.
Right, we can redecorate with appropriate feng shui as quickly as we have put the fire out.
Yeah. Yeah,
by the way, the follow-up, I felt like I was conjuring her. Texas Betsy, Jubilee happens every 50 years, but only in the land of Israel. Debt and, listen to this concept, write this down, jot it down or something, Reverbo, everybody. Verse number would be nice, Texas Betsy. Debt and wealth can only accumulate for two generations. That's biblical. But I'll be damned if I've ever heard the Pastor Whackbottom preach a sermon on it on the TV box. You know, join that at the hip, Reverbo. Debt and wealth can only accumulate for two generations. Join that at the hip with the old Iroquois consideration that no decision can be made that doesn't take into account the next seven generations. What does a world look like where those two things sort of dovetail together and go forward?
What's the global corporate syndicate gonna how are they gonna react to that?
How about mowing down the people in the streets who suggest a heresy like that?
Pretty much, yeah.
Leviticus 25:23 and Leviticus 27:21. That must be the part of Leviticus that doesn't hate homosexuals. Actually, the part of Leviticus does is an itsy-bitsy little tiny part, but to hear Rick Santorum and the rest of the right-wing freaks, you'd think that that was the entirety of the, you know, this is the law and the prophets. But there's a lot of stuff in there they're missing.
What do they do about, like, inherited wealth and you know, land that goes over generations and generations? I don't understand. How do you... people that are somehow tired.
Well, I think it's all there. I mean, they sorted it out in that tribal society. But the fact of the matter is, back then, wealth was much less permanent. It certainly wasn't electronic. The massive banking system, you know, letters of credit might not even have been invented by then. If you wanted, you carried bags of gold around. That's what made over-the-road travel a little bit dodgy. And land stays, this from Texas Betsy again, land stays within the tribe and not within the family. It is, again, a tribal society, and tribal societies are vastly different from nuclear families. Nuclear families are things that only, I mean, we call them nuclear families because they came to fruition in the consumerist age that arose with the nuclear age.
Right, I consume, therefore I am.
Yeah. What would that be? Consumptio ad absurdum?
You remember your Latin better than I do.
But again, that's something that's going on with the Occupy Wall Street folks, Reverbo. The land stays with the tribe, not within the family. Well, what you see in that decision-making process and that care process is, in fact, a form of tribalism. That is not, you know, not a, tribalism doesn't mean bad. Sometimes it has bad outcomes, but it does not mean per se bad. And we have had, you know, we've had manifestations of it. You know, the extended families that settled the great Midwest, you know, where Ma and Pa built a house in the dirt out of sod and expanded the house in the dirt made out of sod as they had babies, and the babies grew up, and then they had families, and they expanded over the land, and they kept farming the land. You know, part of the reason you had children, even here in Appalachia, you know, you started having children early so that you could get them going, and you could have some freaking help.
Well, sure. Well, things like infant mortality rates.
Right. But, I mean, my aunt, one of whom is past 90 now, has told stories about, you know, just about, as she said, as soon as I was 4 or 5 years old, Mama gave me a stool to stand next to her by the sink and help wash and dry the dishes.
There you go.
And she started doing so-called woman's work at a tender age. And that ain't all bad. But it is certainly something that we have presently rejected. And before you do go, I have to tell you, I think I wrote to you about this as well, Reverbo. You have made a real live, honest to God Richard K. Morgan fan out of me.
I have, and you mentioned another book of his.
Yeah, it's in Europe and the rest of the civilized world. It was titled Black. In the United States, it's titled 13. Which, if you read the book, you will find that fact to be wholly ironic as well.
Publishers are still changing titles. It's almost 2012, Bob. Are you sure you're going to stay with? I'm supposed to believe this.
Sorry, yeah. Well, remember, okay. Joe Bagent, Rainbow Pie.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
If it was ever going to be published in the United States, it was supposed to be published under a different title. Shanghai Road.
No.
Because we can't have the Americans finding out where that line Rainbow Pie comes from.
Unless they read the book.
There you go. See how it works?
All right, then.
Ain't it grand?
How it works. Well, you have a good evening, and as usual, make it... Not hard to make it personal.
No, it's getting hard for it not to be.
Really?
And you know what? I want you to know that things like this go well beyond my life behind the microphone, Reverbo, because sitting there on Monday evening talking to that guy from the EPA, I said to him early on, this is not an academic exercise for us. This is personal.
I would think people have to be quiet when someone makes a comment like that, even for just a second.
You could hear a pin drop. And so just a reminder that no one calling this program ever can fully know, and I think it's part of what John was talking about in his email, no one calling this program can ever know the reverberations that their words carry. It's just not hardly possible to know, but you must know that they do. Make sense?
Makes sense. That was a nice call from Malloy, by the way.
Yeah, wasn't that nice? I was just charmed.
Well, you get after him now.
I'm a goner.
All right, man.
See you, Reverbo.
Bye. Bye now.
That's our op-ed correspondent, Reverbo. He of the cavalcade of crazy. And we will move this along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, Jim, what's up?
Happy birthday again.
Thank you very kindly.
Pursuant to the previous conversations you had, I think we're in some rather perilous times here, economically, financially, every other way. Times look pretty dark. And I think that... the forces that would like to change things for the better are going to be fighting a very uphill type of revolution. And that's exactly what it will culminate in because, you know, many times I've said to you, time is not linear. Time is cyclical. And I look back over history and the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and any other types of revolution, I think we're getting to a flashpoint stage in which anything could set something off. And I'm not sure what it's going to take in this country to make people realize that there are more have-nots than there are haves. However, if you should have a natural catastrophe or a political catastrophe, political catastrophe being 84% of the American people do not like what the Congress is doing. And that is not a good report card.
No. And the substantial thing that's changed in that, it's not the first time, Jim, that those kind of numbers have been necessarily seen. But it used to be that when you had those numbers, there would be a general disapproval of Congress. But if you asked a person about his or her incumbent, oh, he's the one doing a good job, those numbers would come back saying that. That's gone now. Because people aren't even reporting favorably on their incumbents or upon their own representative in Congress. They don't like Congress, and they don't like their own. And that is where the sea change lies. That's the definition of a failing, if not already failed, body.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you foresee in the next 10 years is happening?
Well, I'm no good with crystal balls, Jim.
No, but you have ideas. I mean, of course you do.
Obviously there are forks in the road. One of them is coming in 2012.
Okay.
Now, I know I get a lot of pushback from people who say, well, you know, there's really, at the end of the day, no difference between Obama and whichever freak the Republicans are going to nominate. And I understand where that comes from, but I don't necessarily entirely endorse the idea. I think 2012 is another fork in the road. It may turn out, as some have suggested, that Obama with a second term and no pressure of reelection, that we will see him come out full corporate. It's certainly a possibility.
Well, it could go the other way too.
It could, and that's the thing. I think there's a greater likelihood of him going full corporate. I'd say it's probably 70%, 30%. You know, the 30% is that he will suddenly find his inner FDR. But then again, we have to remember historically that FDR didn't start out as FDR. FDR got pushed into it. I mean, look at Prohibition, for instance. He wanted to avoid it, but he was absolutely shoved into opposing Prohibition by Smith.
Right.
Those things. What scares me really is 2016, when there will not be. I mean, come on. I just can't see Joe. I can't see Joe Biden running for his own presidency.
Well, what if a Republican is elected?
If a Republican is elected, and more importantly, Jim, I think in this equation has to be what happens to the United States Senate in 2012. The Republicans will hold on to a majority in the House. If the Republicans take the Senate, then with a Republican in the presidency, it will be rubber stampage all the way to hell. And every last worst thing that we can imagine being done to the United States of America will be attempted. Because where George Bush was defeated in 2005 on his attempt to piratize Social Security, this time they won't be, because he has a House that has completely abdicated all sense of reason and decency, and a Senate that goes along with it. Well, Katie, bar the door, because you know what? The Democrats will not use the rules of the Senate and the filibuster as a cudgel the way the Republicans have. They'll try to get along. They've got a history of it. It's almost Stockholm syndrome in its effect.
And beyond that,
you will see a national security crackdown, and it'll not be some new thing. It will be the logical or illogical or hateful extension of everything that started with Bush and has been perpetuated by Obama. You know, it's one of those things that I say to the Obama apologists. You know, you're going to give Obama a pass for all this national security stuff, and what are you going to do when a Republican takes it and runs it to the next level? You know, there was an opportunity here to stop it and make them at least have to reinvent the wheel. That hasn't happened. So, Marines getting gunned down in Oakland with rubber bullets to the head, laying in critical condition, is going to become more of a norm than an exception. Because I don't see Occupy, I don't see Occupy going away. At the worst, it might condense a little bit during the worst of the winter bad weather, but it will be back. It will be back in full-throated disgust and full-throated demands for justice with the budding of the leaves on the trees. We're heading for a brick wall, Jim. And it's not just what happens in America. We consider what happens in America myopically at our peril. It's what happens in Europe. It's what happens when the euro tanks.
Well, I mean, like I say, we are not in the 60s anymore. This is not the type of situation we had in the 60s and the protests we had back then. This is a whole new ball game. This is a global ball game. I mean, look at what has happened in the Middle East, and look at what is happening in Western Europe.
Precisely, and it's not lost. It's not
to say on this program on a number of occasions is we are heading for a time in which when the bottom collapses out of the structure of the edifice that holds up the top. Then that's when you're going to have an unusual man with an unusual solution.
And those solutions are generally pretty scary.
And political changes are made. And there's no point in, you know, saying it won't happen because it can happen. And I say to you that the same things that have happened in the past in other countries can happen in this country. I mean, we are not isolated.
They won't. No, and I don't think you think that they will happen identically. They will be different by virtue of the character of the people engaging in it. They will be different by virtue of the technology at work.
Well, the technology is there because of the information age in which we are in. But what I'm saying to you is this: the information management and the information ability can accelerate a number of things, which took for a while to occur.
But again, you've got to futurism is so much more difficult now than it was in the past, because in the past a lot of the future would be defined by little dribs and drabbles of technological innovation. You know, what were we told, for instance, and you can remember this better than I because you were there and I was not. What were we told, Jim, with the advent of the atomic age? Well, one of these days, the country's going to be powered entirely by atomic energy and electricity will be free. That promise was made at one point. Well, it didn't come true.
No.
Anybody
who had any sense would realize that any type of central generation of electricity could be monitored and it could be assessed and would have to be paid for. I mean, that was absolutely absurd. I mean, that was the point of building nuclear reactors and things of this nature, because they could be,
capitalized and profitized.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, these nuclear reactors that everybody thought were so wonderful, and we talked about this before, it takes, I don't know how many years to build a nuclear plant, and how many years does it take to decommission one, because they don't last forever.
Right, and there's a fairly short life in the middle.
Exactly.
It's a lot of donut with just a little bit of eclair in the middle.
Right, and, of course, you've got to dispose of the waste and this, that, and the other, and not to get off on that particular tangent of generation of power, but I mean, I'm just saying there are a number of things that we've been told that simply have not come to pass.
But there are two things, Jim, in this kind of analysis that I think we have to take into account as being dramatically different than any other cycle has been before us, and that is this. One, for the most part, there was always a stable energy supply, whether it be wood or coal or, you know, setting fire to dried peat moss or manure even.
Well, but these are finite resources.
Right, but we're dealing now with a situation where there is a coming collapse and I don't want to sound like Glenn Beck and encourage people to go out and buy dried Mormon food or anything, but there is a coming collapse within energy that if we are not prepared for, they will bear the seeds of revolution. That's one. Two, climate change is catastrophic climate change. You know, there was science out in the last week that said, and I think Brad and Desi mentioned it on the Thursday Green News Report, that the scientists were wrong about global warming's impact on this planet. Only they were wrong in that they overly conservatively estimated the effects. Things are happening much faster than they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And third is I had third just a minute ago. Give me a second here. Where did third go? There were three things. Energy, climate change, as far as the United States is concerned, our economic abilities themselves. A lot of people want to compare what may be coming down the pike with the Great Depression. But from the standpoint of where the United States is, the one thing that the Great Depression had that we do not have is the Great Depression involved idled manufacturing facilities. People couldn't go to work in factories because the factories couldn't stay open because the economy had collapsed. Okay? But the factories were there and could be rejuvenated over time and began to be well before World War II broke out. That is not the case now.
World War II was the very thing that brought this country out of the Depression.
Well, the Second Depression, yes. But the Depression had begun. The Depression.
All of, President Roosevelt's alphabet soup agencies to correct things.
I think you would
reverse back in 36-37, which was largely started by his efforts to pack the Supreme Court from 9 to 13.
Well, the other thing that happened in 1937 was Henry Morgenthau's insistence, much as we have heard in recent years, of, well, you know, we got to be careful about the debt. We got to be careful about and it's what the capitalists always do. We were on the road to recovery in 1937, and because FDR engaged in a certain amount of austerity beginning then, we redepressed. But the overarching point is that we had a manufacturing base that could be reinvigorated. Well, we don't have that now, Jim. The factories, I mean, I saw it for myself in terms of the furnace that my father worked on. The factories themselves were literally dismantled. The pieces were numbered, and they were sent to China.
Well, right. That's what I'm saying. We're not living in, you know, the 60s or the 30s. We are facing a whole new set of problems. And the thing that frightens me the most are natural catastrophes that can split this country in two. And we've talked about this before. I mean, every night I see on the Green Channel, History Channel, what would happen if Yellowstone were to go berserk. It could split this country in two.
Absolutely.
This would put a factor into the equation that would change the entire outcome and the results. Because what we're talking about is the collapse of the means of distribution to goods, services, everything we know. And, you know, no one is prepared for this.
We have a system that is far more fragile than we dare even contemplate. You know, for that matter, Jim, we don't even know what the full outcome of Fukushima is. Every now and then I see stories about rising radiation levels in midtown Tokyo, and you go, what?
They're going to keep that as quiet as they possibly can.
Yeah, not that that's going to show up on the for-profit media any more than, as Andy just noted in an email a little bit ago, he said, you know, where's the for-profit media on Scott Olson? The corporate media is absolutely silent and absent.
Well, unfortunately, we are facing some very serious problems, and, of course, that is the understatement of the 21st century. And there are other things that are happening in the world that weren't happening with such acuity back in those decades past to which we have referenced our conversation previously. But like I say, an immediate and catastrophic geographic or geologic or atmospheric or whatever, it's going to have to be factored in. And we have no means to combat these things. No more than Pharaoh did the seven plagues or the 10 plagues or whatever of Egypt.
Right, or what was he? Was it King Canute who stood at the shore and ordered the sea to recede?
Not to command.
Pardon?
And commanded the tide not to wet his boots.
Right. Yeah, didn't work. Went home with wet feet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And unfortunately, we are living in very serious times. And, of course, you know, we've heard this on the program many, many times. I wish there could be happier news for people to share. I wish there could be more playing Manhattan Transfer, stuff like that. By the way, I just got that CD in the mail today. And, you know, I wish it were a happier time. But unfortunately, it is not a happier time.
No, but by the same...
I'm so disenchanted with everything relating to our government and relating to what it is doing to try to alleviate the situation. You have one element that's trying to do something about it. You have another element that's in lockstep to change it. And with all their bizarre ideas, which, you know, any modern thinking economist will realize that, you know, this is just not going to work. I mean, like that idiot Kane, 999. I mean, you have...
Oh, God, have you seen... And I just have to ask you, have you seen his other insane television commercials?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you owe it to yourself, Jim. There's one that's a faux Western called He Carried Yellow Roses.
And what does that mean?
It's set up like a Western, and a cowboy's riding with a bouquet of yellow roses. And I can't describe it to you. I cannot describe it to you because it is completely twisted. If you were to offer any sort of cogent analysis or explanation of meaning behind it, there would have to be psychotropic medications involved. It's nuts. Just Mother Jones had a good breakdown of his ads. It's crazy. And this latest one he's got, where the guy's smoking a cigarette and blows smoke into the camera lens. That's why I'm voting for Herman Cain. Crazy. Crazy, Jim.
And the point is?
Damned if I know.
Well.
The point is, the guy's nuts.
Well.
And I don't just throw that around.
It will not be the first time in history when people who are nuts manage to gain the pinnacle of power. And like I say, their time is very short and very brief, because it doesn't take, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And I just simply think that we are headed for some very serious problems, and it would only take just and basically what I'm trying to say is, you have politicians in Washington now, and you have certain interest groups and things of that nature who are literally walking into a room filled with gunpowder with a lighted cigarette.
Yep.
You know, we've almost come back to 1913, 1914. Think about it.
Yeah, sometimes. With the royal families and their one last hurrah. That was at the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria.
Well, that occurred back a little bit before then,
right? But
of course, her son Edward the Edward the Seventh came on the throne, and of course, he was known as the grandfather of Europe, and he sort of kept the thing together.
But with the conglomeration of all these global players, yeah, there is a distinct similarity, Jim.
Yeah, there is. I mean, Edward the Seventh was the grandpa of Europe, and that the other, and then, of course, after Edward the Seventh came George the Fifth, and George the Fifth was not exactly known as Papa England, I think, but he basically was very worried about keeping his own ascendancy on the throne because he could see these things coming. And, of course, when World War One occurred, and you had three dynasties collapse, the Hohenzollerns, the Romanovs, and the Habsburgs. And that's when Europe became divided into successor states. And, of course, after the Versailles Treaty and the revanche type of things that were in all 448 articles of that treaty, of course, less than 20 years later, from 1919 to 1939, you can see what happened in Europe.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about an unusual man with an unusual solution. Because there are a lot of people, I'm not saying this as my own opinion, I'm just saying there is a possibility that the things could get so bad that people will turn to anything that will give them some sort of sense of security. And
perceived, not actual, but perceived security.
Well, exactly. And, when we're talking about Adolf Hitler, and for the first couple of years of his administration, in spite of his horrible persecution of the Jews, Germany put on a real good face. It blew a real good bugle. So basically, what I'm saying is you've got a lot of twisted politicians out there, and God only knows who's going to come out on top. And I certainly hope that it isn't a repeat of the past. But as I said before, time is cyclical. It is not linear.
And if you dig deep, it's there are deep cycles. And one of the things that we may be seeing, Jim, is the recycling of the resurgence of both India and China, because they have had their day in the sun and they've been a long time in the shadows, and that day is ending as well. You know, you've got crazy ass Pat Buchanan out there who really should be eating oatmeal in a home, writing books about the death of white America, you know, deliberately trying to stoke up race hatreds and race fears. When what he's talking about are simple realities. I am not terrified, Jim, of an America that is majority-minority in 2044.
But we have.
But he is, and many of his ilk are.
In certain ways, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, we are a polyglot nation of many ethnic groups, of many nationalities. And look at what happened to the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1914. I mean, the very man who was trying to pull it together and was trying to give the respective nationalities more voice in their government
was gunned down.
Exactly. The Archduke Ferdinand, he was the one who wanted to establish, I think, something called the United States of Austria. I mean, he had such realized that you couldn't ignore the Slavs and you couldn't allow the Magyars and the other and the Germans to dominate the Habsburg monarchy. Well, the same thing can be applied to this country as well. And if you look at it through a glass darkly, I think you'll see what I'm trying to say.
I do. And in fact,
I'm saying it very well.
No, you're getting where you need to be, Jim. And I get it more than you and everybody else does, I think, as well. Jim, this has been amazing.
It took one gunshot.
Yeah.
From one guy roaming the streets who thought he had missed his target to initiate the immediate cause of a very bad situation.
Gavrilo Princeps?
Exactly. He was 19 years old, and of course he was part of the Serbian Black Hand. But nonetheless, besides the immediate cause of the assassination of the Archduke, you had all the underlying causes of that particular situation that had really begun in 1870 and went all the way through 1914.
You know, you make me want to really go back and reread The Guns of August.
Well, I think it's a good thing for you to read because it's one of John F. Kennedy's favorite books, because I think Kennedy had the...
It's a cautionary tale.
Well, he had the perspicacity and the knowledge of history, because he was very much, he loved history. And if you listen to the CDs that come with the book that was dictated by Mrs. Kennedy to Schlesinger, she will constantly refer to that. and how her husband was so very much mindful of the lessons of history and the lack of people to pay attention to those lessons of history.
Has there been any president since, Jim, with that deep seated comprehension of the importance of knowing history?
I would think that probably Lyndon Johnson may have been a close second, because he was more of a pragmatist than Kennedy was in certain respects. But he got himself so wrapped around being the creator of the Great Society, and that has not worked. And, of course, the Vietnam conflict and what it did to this country and how it drained our resources and drained our morale. And
I think Jimmy Carter,
any president since John F. Kennedy who has really met the mark that he did.
I think Jimmy Carter had an appreciation of history and a sense for the future. Because that was clearly on display when he talked to America about how we needed to consider our position vis-a-vis the fuels and energy, energy going forward. But beyond that, no, not so much.
But Carter was, in his own respect, very isolated and extremely opinionated, and he could not work together with other people. He did not. He simply could not pull it together. And it didn't work for him. And he was thrown out by Reagan.
And of course, we forget at our peril that John Kennedy pissed off more than a little bit of the existing power structure. The CIA hated him. His joint chiefs hated him. Tried to push him around until he pushed back. Jim, this has been a magnificent conversation, and I do appreciate it.
Well, I'm sorry I've taken so long.
No worries at all. No worries at all. I just want to make sure we hit the other blinking lights.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye now. That book I mentioned, 13, Talking to Reverbo, contains a little statement. If you don't know where you've been, how do you know where you're going? That's history. That's knowledge of what Jim describes as the cyclical nature of history. Just to elaborate a little bit on Andy's note about Scott Olson. He says, it appears awfully brutal, just brutal. I'm even in the neighborhood. The police are under orders to clear these parks. Any excuse. The catch-all is public health hazard. Will do. Just move them all out of the park. You'd think a military man, a Marine, would get some airtime in the media. You got it right, Bob. Many of these occupiers are anarchists. They believe in a flat hierarchy. There are no leaders, yet everyone is a leader. The CIA and Homeland Security must be going nuts, pulling their hair out. Who do they track? Who do they intimidate? Who do they rough up and interrogate? It's tough to keep your eye on everyone. This coming in from Michael, Kid A from the chat room. Happy Horniversary, Bob. Michael's always good for one of those. That's it. It's our Horniversary. I'm not sure if he coined it this himself or not, but I like this quote. If you don't know history, you don't know shit. Signed, my dad. I like your dad, Michael. He's a smart, smart man. And it's the absolute truth. Andy will be pleased to know that the Olson case is getting some coverage on MSNBC on Ed Schultz's program. Kate noting, and you know, it's context, and it's just beautiful. Kate noting, was there any mention that the Yellow Rose of Texas is about a high yellow female enchantress? No, at least not on the surface. How ironic, she says, Mr. Pizza would endorse an ad like that. Oh, how we need to teach more history lest we step in huge piles of irony. And you know what? When you step in them, they don't smell real good, that irony. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
Thank you very much for 6 years of Horn Radio.
Well, thank you and everyone else for making it worthwhile. and even possible.
It's been a real blessing in my life, I'll tell you that.
Well, that is a road that runs in both directions. You have no idea. We have been blessed beyond measure to have this conversation go on like this. And that's what it's been. It's been a 6-year-long conversation, hasn't it?
Yeah. And it is a happy birthday or happy Horn's Day.
Horniversary. It's a Horniversary.
Happy Horniversary, yeah. That's good. I like that. I got a quote for you.
Okay.
Whoever is there, and let's just assume it's Obama, we expect him to do the work of the people. Obama can either go down as a historic president who becomes the FDR of this century, or he can be remembered as the man who was in the pocket of Goldman Sachs.
It's really a pretty bold, and you can't do both. Who said that?
Michael Moore.
Yeah. Like I said, I love Michael Moore.
I thought that just was very succinct. You know, it just said a lot.
But the problem is he has shown little propensity toward being FDR. But I'm going to give him credit for this student loan thing.
I'm going to give him credit, you know, for what he's doing now. But I'm not told to press too long. You know what I'm saying? Because we've been our strings have been pulled before.
Yeah, been down that. You're right.
But getting back to the Wall Street Inn?
Oh, Occupy? Occupy?
Occupy Wall Street. I like the 99%. I want to get me something like that on a shirt or something. That I am in the 99%.
Right. I think sometimes just wearing a T-shirt matters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The trouble is, a lot of them, if you order them, they're too small.
Well, you've got to make sure that.
Huge one.
Well, see, I take a size huge. What I run across is they don't so much shrink to where they're too little to get on, they shrink to where they're too short. And, you know, I just don't look cute with that whole Gwen Stefani exposed belly button thing going on. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, neither. But I just wanted to say about all this stuff, I think Mike Malloy was correct that something is behind all of that. Because I do know from hearing some of the right wing, they're out there among them, you know, trying to.
Sure they are.
Yeah, anything they can. Did you know the guy that did, you might have said it, I don't remember, but when they first started, the guy that disguised himself as a pimp.
Oh, yeah, James O'Keefe.
Acorn.
Yeah, James O'Keefe.
You know, he was out there when it first started.
Looking to start something, sure.
Looking for prey, yeah.
And now, you know, this business about passing out Che Guevara and rolling papers and bongs.
I
mean, really, really. But again, I don't put anything past them.
Oh, I don't either.
I'm just waiting. On a larger plane, I'm waiting for Chinless Mitch to McConnell to declare that WVU's move to the Big 12 is a Marxism. Or maybe it's Muslim. Anything. It's all,
whatever.
everything absolutely lunatic and hateful is now, there is no pale to, for, there is no pale for these right-wingers to go beyond. Everything is open.
I used to be so naive, to think that maybe there was something good about them, but you know, Bob, there's just nothing good about them.
I mean,
you can't trust them any further than you could throw a skunk or whatever.
Well, yeah, you can heave a bull.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, exactly. And, you know, here's a little manifestation of that. Now, Lottie in the chat room, one of our chat room moderators, our head moderator, lives in Massachusetts. And, of course, he frequently hears me talk about, things in the South, and you're Southern, too. And we also talk about, you know, it ain't just the South.
No, that's that.
And Lottie got a manifestation of that earlier today. He was out driving around. He sees this vehicle in front of him. It's got a bumper sticker on it that says, No Obama. It's got a pair of squished hands and feet sticking out from behind the tailgate of this SUV. And the trailer hitch, Juanita, is Barack Obama's head.
Well, yeah.
That's a little creepy.
Well, you know, you were talking about what's going to happen. If they do something, and you know, one place, I think it was in Maine, they threw a bomb in the crowd. Somebody threw a homemade bomb in the crowd.
Jesus. Flash grenades.
You know that?
Rubber bullets. Yeah.
And then that's shades of Jeb Bush, what happened.
Well, and this is, you know, this is the then they fight you part of that whole Gandhi-esque equation. You know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win.
But you know what?
But we don't.
You had Martin Luther King, and then you had Malcolm X. And we've got the equivalent. And the ones that are more the equivalent of who can't hack it long enough, God bless them, the Malcolm X among us is going to rise up.
Yep.
I don't know how, but I don't think it'd be pretty.
No, no.
Because these people, they're just so ridiculous. Anytime you turn on Fox News, you'll hear something just so ridiculous. Did you hear about, I'm sure you know about, what's his name, the show? Anyway, they had Alan Grayson on, and this other guy from New York City, he's a real right-winger. And he was telling Alan Grayson how he would fit in with those people because of, did you see that? You know what I'm talking about?
I don't think I did.
Okay, well, it was on Bill Maher show. And that guy was saying, well, you know, they're all unwashed and they're this and that and the other. You just said horrible things and you just fit right in. And he said, well,
Oh, yeah, when he schooled P.J. O'Rourke.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right, yeah. I know what you're talking about now.
And then Alan Grayson said what he said.
Alan Grayson just wore him out.
And Bill Maher said that was the first time that had happened on his show.
Needs to happen more. Then again, what's P.J. O'Rourke doing on there? You know, hey, Juanita, I got to roll. I want to make sure we try to hit all the lights. But it's awful good to hear from you, dear. All right.
Okay. Night, night.
Bye now. Juanita calling from Central Florida. And by the way, our keeper of the toasters has awarded a toaster tonight to Michael for Horniversary, as well as by extension to Michael's dad. For if you don't know history, you don't know shit. You can collect your toaster, Michael. thanks very much. Let's see, onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, I welcome your voice to the airwaves of the Internet, and this is your fellow American, Mark, and I want to say to Jim and Juanita, I may have grown up in Abraham Lincoln's hometown. I would die for these good Americans, and I would die for good Americans like yourself, Bob. You guys... fought against your own people without fighting against your own people. And you guys all deserve black diplomatic passports for being the Americans that you are. And if you listen to your voices, your Americans that are that have walked the walk because you're a little older, and I'm glad your metatarsals are doing good, Bob. My father was raised, Bob, in government housing. He's dark-complected. He married a German girl. Her last name is Dirksen. She's related to the Dirksens that have that building in Washington. He's one of the, what the Southerners would call a politician, a statesman. But he thinks Yeah, Senator Wright, Ward Member Dirksen, thought that people like you and me, Bob, and Juanita, and Jim, and all the other callers were important Americans. I'm a former policeman as well, Bob. For various reasons, I was an honest policeman and went back into the Marine Corps. I just would let Jim know, and I know Jim knows this, but any listeners, including all the idiots in the Air Force that are eavesdropping, that should be receiving a GS-11 pay, and they're getting paid E-3 pay for this radio show. That's probably eavesdrop, which we Americans that have testicles don't really care, and backbone, regardless you've got testicles.
Yeah, ovaries count, too.
I'm sorry, Bob.
I said ovaries count, too, Mark.
Say again?
Ovaries count, too. Testicles, ovaries, right. And backbone. It's all backbone.
It is all backbone, and actually women will eventually beat men in the marathon because they've always handled pain better than us. I've known that for a long time, and I am not much of an arm wrestler because I was such a runner and a bicyclist, but I just would let the my fellow citizens know in this great country of the United States with the first black American president, of which we are all proud to be a part of, that total information awareness does not get started with John Poindexter, the naval officer. It gets started back in the, I think in the 30s, and there's actually a Bush connection to that. And I also let Jim know that there's a general that worked for John F. Kennedy, where your conversation tapered off, and I'll make it quick, Bob. And happy birthday to your family and all our whole family, that David M. Shoup worked for Smedley Butler, ironically, in China. And then he went on to stay in the Marine Corps as Butler leaves, the son of a Quaker Butler. And David M. Shoup receives a Medal of Honor for some action, apparently, in, Guam or Iwo Jima. And he tells John Kennedy, don't put boots on the ground in Southeast Asia. And, of course, Lyndon Baines Johnson's Halliburton was there first, commonly called Brown and Root, which did work with the U.S. military and Shell Oil. And let's not forget that we financed the French being there. So it's still for Southern whites, for Northern whites, for Northern blacks, for Southern blacks, for Americans dying for rich white Americans.
Well, Mark, I have to ask you. It would be, and perhaps it's inappropriate or hyper appropriate either way. Where is this country going when an Iraq, a two-tour Iraq Marine, is laying in a hospital bed in critical condition from a rubber bullet from a peaceful protest?
I would answer that question with the question that came to you, Bob, from our friend Jen. Because Jen's asking Bob, and Bob's asking Mark, and Bob's asking Mike Malloy, a native northerner who lives in the South, who loves everybody. We don't know. And actually, it's kind of like the 47-year-old Revolutionary War soldier who grabbed a rifle in a situation in Boston at the turn of the Revolutionary War century. Gave the rifle back to the British soldier, Bob, and then he shot him with it. That was Crispus Attucks. We don't know until the chips fall down. But we all know that the corporate-controlled media, which is ran by General Electric and Siemens, and the multinational investors that have no allegiance to any nation, will spin it the best way they can. So,
and sometimes that is simply silence.
And it may work for us, Bob, but we can only hope that God is on our side. It's a roulette wheel. I'm not a gambler. I don't gamble with much. I drink a little white wine. I don't gamble with much, Bob. So I just want to tell you happy birthday. Happy birthday to the folks that have the courage to listen to one of the best Americans this country has right now. And I always get emotional because I think you're quintessential. I have MSNBC muted. I love Mike Malloy, but Bob, whenever you feel lonely, I'm always in your heart. So God bless you. Gotta go.
Thank you, friend. Thank you, Mark. Take care.
God bless you.
Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. It's what we say to one another. Not, you know, and again, I reiterate, what you say is not necessarily said to me. It's what we say to one another. that passes through this conglomeration, this stream, this electronic data flow, that is the change agent. This is where profound, it's been 6 years of profundity. Well, there have been a few shows along the way where I closed the mic and just sort of huddled in the corner in a fetal ball and sucked my thumb a little bit, but for the moment, no, I kid. But no, you are all what makes this the profound experience for me that it is. So I guess it's time to knock off. Time to say goodnight. Now, the rest of the week is as normal, to the extent, Peter Godbold, that normal can be anything other than sitting on a dryer, the rest of the week is as normal. Show tomorrow, show Friday, and then back at it on Monday. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for all the kind contributions this evening, each and every last one of you. Thank you very much. It's what keeps all of this going, simply put. And bless your hearts, we recovered the lost cost of the boots, and onward to metatarsal support. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie, Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Susan, you are especially in our thoughts this evening. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to Reverbo. Great conversation this evening, Reverbo. Thank you. And when he puts electrons to screen and writes, it's amazing. Cavalcade of Crazy, headonradionetwork.com. Thanks to my head writer, David in Tennessee. David is one of those who has been with us since before October 24th, 2011. He was a listener way back when in the bad old days of terrestrial radio. Thank you to another member of the Fraternity of Davids, David in South Carolina. He wrote to say, happy to say I've been a listener and participant from pre-horn days. That's back when the horn was in the visioning stage, the terrestrial radio days. This is indeed truly a family experience. We've shared ups, downs, sideways, sadness, happiness, the worst, the best, and everything in between. I know how difficult it can be to be a liberal in the South. The air here in South Carolina is combustible, yet I persist, as do the rest of our Horn family, because we are sustained and inspired by each other. By the way, my daughter, Candace, has literally grown up listening to the Horn. The Horn helps us realize that we are all in this together. Cheers to all. Peace. David, Lynn, and Candace. Thank you, David. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Candace. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to John Fox, the chief engineer of the Horn family. Thank you. A special thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Only because of what Ben Birch began in 2002 at White Rose Society were we able to come back from being run off terrestrial air to being able to do live radio. Thank you, Ben. Rick Smith is next. Thanks go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Learn about the Coal River Wind.